papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Welcome to the Media Project, an opportunity for us to actually, hopefully with precision and care, look at some issues of the week instead of what our producer, David Gassina, is urging us to explode like Vesuvius is for the ratings, of course, even on public radio. I'm kidding. Anyway, I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. Dr. Alan Sharktalk is there. How you doing there,
yo,
Professor?
Yo,
there he be. Ira Fussfeld is here, the publisher emeritus of the Kingston Daily Freeman and affiliated publications.
Hello, Rex.
Sir, wonderful to see you. And Dr. Kaylin Brown, who runs the journalism program at the College of St. Rose and was herself a longtime reporter before she went off and became a doctor.
Hi, Rex. How are you?
Anyway, Ira, what are you and I going to do with these PhDs around? How do we defend ourselves?
I'm just going to keep getting older and fade into the Netherlands.
I thought you were going to say older and wiser like
no,
Alan.
No, too late.
Anyway, well, we welcome you all as we look at some of the issues in the media this week. And we actually have some letters from listeners, which we appreciate. You can send us mail at media@wamc.org. Here's someone who is upset that the Times Union has published stories about this so-called sex cult, Nexium. Lester says, instead of Nexium ad nauseum. That's kind of a nice little turn of phrase. How about some more front page or Section 1 reports on the state and local impacts of decisions made in D.C., regulations, taxes, voting, from a TU subscriber? Thank you. Actually, that's a thoughtful suggestion.
Absolutely, Lester. That's what we want to do, localize the national issues and make them resonate for the people who are reading their local papers.
Exactly. We actually, our new Washington correspondent just dropped into our newsroom yesterday. We share a Washington correspondent with the Hearst newspapers in Connecticut. So we have basically half of somebody who's supposed to do exactly what you're talking about, local impact of D.C. stories. She's a very bright young woman who starts her job next month. So we will see what we can do
for you. Well, it's encouraging that you still have the money in the budget to do that.
Yeah.
Although years ago, now not for necessarily for papers that the size of which mine was and is, the larger papers, of course, have always had people in Washington. And I remember, on the other hand, a smaller paper like the one in Watertown, I think you referred to it last week. Watertown was one of the first papers of its size to have somebody in Washington, largely because of the presence of Fort Drum in their market and the defense industry, et cetera. But I'm surprised to hear, and I'm glad to hear, that you're able to have somebody in Washington.
It seems like it would be a terrible time right now to lose a Washington correspondent, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
To give up that position in the budget. So, yes, it's tough when you're facing the loss of brick-and-mortar stores that have provided the advertising revenues that have sustained the newsrooms over the years. But we just feel as though that position is necessary.
I just want to ask you something, Rex. Not that I'm a provocateur or anything.
No, you never play that role.
Provocateur. And that is, you mentioned that you share this reporter with the Connecticut Hearst papers. Does there ever come that moment when you need something and they need something, there's only one person, and then you've got to duke it out?
Well, I haven't duked it out with the Connecticut editor yet, but it's like any other reporter on a beat. You're constantly trying to allocate your hours because there's more news than you can possibly cover. I mean, I think Kaylin can speak to that, having been a beat reporter for years. You have to choose what you're going to do somehow, right?
Well, we used to work split shifts at the Troy Record, where we come in for 6 hours in the morning and
wow.
6 hours in the late afternoon. I don't know if that was a legit experience for us to be having. In fact, I know it wasn't, because I know the Labor Department made a move on that.
Right.
You were paid overtime, no doubt, I'm sure.
I never saw the light of day. But 5 stories a day was not uncommon at all.
Mm.
But the point that Alan is making, it it's not unusual at all, whether it's two newspapers sharing someone in Washington or within our own newsrooms at home. You have a raft of stories to cover, and you make a determination of which takes priority. And I suspect that there are going to be times that Rex is going to be looking for a story, and it's going to be overshadowed by something in Connecticut that they're going to cover.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Here's somebody in a letter, Mary Beth, thank you, who has...
You didn't answer my question, of course. I wanted to know, how does it work? Is the more important newspaper, is the Times Union more important than the Connecticut newspaper? Is the fact that George Hearst is your publisher become more important than if some other person might be somewhere? You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. The answer is no. I thought I did say I'd never duked it out. That was your specific question.
Nah, yeah, no. It's a metaphor.
I don't have that PhD. So the
you certainly don't.
No. When there is a question as to how a reporter's time is spent, the right thing to do is to try to ascertain whether, you listen to a reporter on the beat. As the most great journalism comes from reporters' notebooks, not editors' desktops. So you need to know what the reporter is being able to find. And if I ever feel as though I'm not getting my money's worth out of the shared Washington correspondent, I will holler. But so far, so good.
Yeah, okay, sounds very goody-two-shoes.
Yeah, that's me.
You know, I don't want to speak for...
That's not what it sounded like before we went on air.
I'm not a product of Hearst. I think what Alan is describing is just normal business. We make decisions, and sometimes we're going to be disappointed because the other newspaper is going to be benefiting. And if the Albany Times Union is a larger, more profitable paper and thus considered more important to the Hearst Company than any one of the papers in Connecticut, It ought to get precedent if there's a conflict. So,
and Alan, you have familiarity with this, right? When there are resource allocation issues, you have to determine where to put the resources, even if it's not a shared reporter.
Yeah.
Well, we're very lucky, actually, because we have a lot of reporters. And they cover particular areas. But
everything's great here at WAMC. That's
pretty
right.
Much.
Everything is covered.
But I pretty much. But I do think that what Rex is saying happens to be right, despite the fact that I don't like to agree with him ever. And I think that the reporter has a great deal to do with it, because if we've got a guy in Springfield, they have to make up their mind what is more important. Even if we're sitting at the other side of the radio and saying, was that a good choice?
It also means reporters have to advocate for the work they're doing. Yeah. I remember one of my techniques was to make sure to have a photographer with at all times, because I knew my story would play better if it had art.
Absolutely. And in the digital era, you have to have photography. There must be a visual with every story, or it doesn't get attention on handheld devices. And since mobile is so much now a part of how people consume their news, look, we all have our mobile devices here with us in the studio. That is important, by the way.
So let me get this straight. So in the old days, there were photographers. It was always a photographer came around. Now, the reporter is expected to do some photography themselves, right?
True. We do teach that in the classroom. They're trained to be able to do it all. Record, edit, do audio, do video.
And sweep the floor.
And make sure they're good writers.
Yeah, the modern young journalists are taught to do so much more. They have to do a lot more. They have to be good at everything, which is impossible, of course. We're really asking too much of them. But
thankfully, these digital natives are so adept at the technology that they're producing excellent work.
There are still photographers, you know, full-time photographers who we send to do the story. When we need great photographs, the stories that need to have extraordinary photography, we want to have a professional photographer shoot it. But if you're just looking for a headshot of an official at a press conference, you know, the mobile phones that people carry produce better photography than the best, most expensive cameras produced a few years ago.
Absolutely right.
So a reporter ought to be able to, even the an old reporter, somebody my age, ought to be able to snap a headshot at a press conference.
But isn't photography, like everything else, intuitive in some cases In other words, there are just some people who know how to do it. They were born that way, as opposed to...
Photojournalism was a skill. It was a separate area of our industry, and the professional photojournalists, in fact, do have an eye that might be better than a news reporter who's trained to and experienced dealing with non-photography issues. But that's just something that's gone by the boards. It's another change in our industry. There are fewer full-time photographers in our newsroom.
But it's not, they have talent and skill. I mean, you get a photographer who can shoot the exact moment when that perfect jump shot is going to hit the basket. You know, that is a skill that is extraordinary, and I respect it so much.
Or somebody who really knows, like our Skip Dickstein, who has retired full-time from us, but we still bring him back to shoot the track at Saratoga. He is the world's best equine photographer. Actually, he has been given such awards, in effect, to that, but he knows where to put himself to get great photos and has enough experience to be able to visualize what he's going to see before it actually happens. It's a great skill. Somewhat learned, somewhat intuitive, as Alan makes the point. I was going to give Kaylin credit here because this listener who wrote Mary Beth twice in this lengthy letter says, hooray. Well, here's one. Hooray for Ms. Brown, because of the point that you made that schools need to teach students to be educated in matters of critical reading and thinking, current affairs, and the relevance of history in issues today. Not, she says, that she doesn't intend to jump on schools because everybody is doing that, but how do you retrain a cohort that has already started solidifying its opinions? Students, at least, might be more receptive to such educational efforts, saying basically that citizens, to be able to not be, in her words, a sucker in television news, need to be more educated onto the nuances of what's going on, to be aware of public affairs. So you said that that's important in education, Kaylin, and she liked that.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mary Beth. Mm-hmm. Appreciate you taking the time.
Well, there may be a little goo-goo-foo-foo here in that everybody says we should educate our kids better, we should make them better in terms of as consumers of news and the rest. And yet, there are always intervening variables that occur. In other words, a teacher says, now you should know that Trump, has done this or that. And then you get a deputation saying, no, you're wrong. I think we have to recognize that it's easy to say we should educate better, but that there are a lot of things that come between lip and cup here.
True. A lot of things. Among them is the changing nature of the media. Listener Jeff writes to us saying, with respect to what's going on in Washington, unfortunately, the press made Trump and now they can't control him. Unfortunately, it's because of changes in technology that have weakened the press to become more commercial, more about entertainment, less objective, less thorough, less detailed. News is now in sound bites that have become shorter and shorter, trying to win shock value. Trump speaks in sound bites. The written press has been dying a quick death. I think he means a slow death, actually. And they were once the place where you can count on the more thorough and more objective voice. Now local papers are all about generic, syndicated stories. On that last point, accurate at all, as a matter of fact. My paper often doesn't have any wire copy in it. I wish we had more space to be able to give people more stories about what's going on around the rest of the world. We are all about local, and local papers are increasingly focusing their attention on what's going on in their communities because that's what differentiates them from the national press.
Well, but here's where we disagree. The fact is, what you are doing is admirable and is the right way to go. Newspapers must have this local content because it distinguishes them from other media. Unfortunately, papers smaller than Rex's, which have suffered severe cutbacks and always use a certain amount of wire copy because in many communities they were the only newspaper source of information in town. I believe there is more wire copy in those newspapers because there are not enough reporters to fill up the pages. Even though the number of pages are fewer,
wow,
there's still a news hole to be filled. And sadly, I'm not being critical of my former newspaper, but there's a significant amount of local, but there is a equally significant amount of wire copy.
Huh.
And I believe that that is a trend that's going on at many small newspapers because they simply don't have enough local copy to fill the news hole.
And one other thing, and that is this idea that the press goes for the obvious and the rest. Remember, there was Pulitzer, right, Rex? And people like that who really made their reputations as people who were bringing up stuff that would excite the public.
Sensational stuff, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. The tradition of sensationalism in journalism actually was a huge thing early in the 20th century, when Pulitzer versus Hearst was the big battle in New York City and at their other papers around the country. And we went through a time, I remember, earlier in my career when people thought that newspapers were too stuffy, too boring, that we didn't have enough that was interesting. And looking back on this as the golden age of journalism, at that time we thought, gosh, we need to reach people at what interests them rather than just what we think is important. So I think it's a little bit unfair to say, gosh, things were so much better before. In some ways, we are doing better journalism than ever before. Although it's all tempered by saying the resource issues are real. You know, we just don't have enough people to do all the work that needs to be done.
Well, let's put the New York Post up against the Times Union. You know, they're two different papers. I think we have to remember that there are lots of different papers, and that very often they take different approaches to this. There are some people who think, you know, that some of these papers are boring still, and some think the New York Post is just way too sensational.
Mm-hmm.
So if we circle back in the classroom, how do we get young people excited about reading, just that act of reading, and then supplement that with reading the news? Mm-hmm. You know, those are the questions that educators are faced with. How do I introduce this in the classroom? How do I encourage engagement? And how do you bring that forward into adulthood?
It's very difficult, and I think that the fact that we weren't as worried about that 20 years ago is the reason why we've seen some of the success of the sensational cable news presentations. If you look, for example, at, well, let's just say the success of Fox News, I think it's appealing to a sort of desire for entertainment, and we all like to be entertained. You know, I don't want to be highfalutin about this, but Fox is simplifying, giving people the red meat sometimes of, let's say, racism and classism. And that appeals to people because we haven't, perhaps, in prior generations made that serious effort to get people to read, to pay attention, to think critically as much as we should have. But the example these recent weeks has been Fox News is probably behind Donald Trump's attack on Baltimore. A little bit ago, as we now speak, the president went off on Twitter against Congressman Elijah Cummings in his district in Maryland. He said that it was
rat infested.
Yeah, just kind of amazing. Disgusting rat and rodent infested mess. No human being would want to live there. The implication being that Congressman Cummings ought to be focusing his attention on that instead of anything else. Of course, you could say that the president of the United States might be as much responsible for rodents in Baltimore as the congressman. I don't know why it's not everybody's responsibility, but it seems as though the president was responding to something that he watched on a 6 a.m. segment in Fox and Friends weekend. And that sort of thing, that sort of, let's say, entertainment-infused news programming is reaching to the president of the United States as well as to ordinary citizens.
Well, but this is more an indictment against Trump than it is against Fox News. And God knows I don't approve of the kind of journalism that Fox News does. But the fact of the matter is he watched something on Fox News at 6 o'clock in the morning, and at 7 o'clock in the morning he tweeted about it. Right after he finished tweeting about it, he went out and played golf. He was going to just shrug it off as just another of his tweets. And unbeknownst to him, while he was on the golf course, this story became a firestorm. And the fact that the president of the United States saw a story on Fox News and was provoked to cover it or to tweet it without having done any research on his own, just gut instinct, that's the problem. He's getting his information from Fox News, and Fox News' information is at the very least suspect.
Well, I got to say, Ira, I remember riding up from New York City on the train with legislators. And seeing them tear stuff out of the paper and hand it to their aide and say, hey, this looks good, get me some of this. I mean, make a bill out of this. So I don't think this is brand new, although I agree with you, it's quite insidious.
Well, what's brand new about it is that presumably once those articles were given to staff, somebody other than the the provocateur read him and decided whether or not it made sense, or at least put a little thought into it. This is simply the guy watching something on TV and tweeting about it without consulting anybody else. By the way, is this true? Could this be really true? No, it just went out and parroted it.
The previous letter from Mary Beth also made the point that she thinks that the media should ignore these outbursts, like Trump's tweets, entirely, except if they contain an element of real import. What do you think
about
that?
You can't do that. I mean, he's the president of the United States. He's got his finger on the button. If he says something, it automatically becomes considered as policy. You can't ignore a president of the United States. How can you do that?
And in the converse situation, Victor Blackwell at CNN, a Baltimore native, made a point of defending his hometown and was borderline in tears on the air, calling the president out for his racism.
And that is interesting. Let's get into, on that point, into the question about how the networks and CNN most recently have handled the debates so far. I was struck by the fact that in the CNN debates, Don Lemon, quite specifically as a CNN moderator, used the term racism to refer to the president, to talk about his racist tweets and so on. You know, and Trump has really gone after Lemon, insulting his intelligence. And Lemon pretty clearly said, very directly said, as a matter of fact, referred to the president's racist tweets and so on.
Well, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. CNN was ahead of virtually all of the other media in not saying alleged racism, did not dance around it. They called his comments, his prior comments about Cummings and whatever else preceded, I don't even remember now, they flat out called it racism.
Wait, I remember. It's the four women.
That's exactly
the
right.
Squad. The four, that's the important squad. That we talk about who he attacked.
That's correct. And then other media organizations have come around to the fact that they're just flat out calling them racist. And the discussion that we had here, as you might recall, was, is that the appropriate thing for the press to do? Because it is, in fact, a value judgment you are making, as opposed to saying alleged and let somebody else say it's racist.
It's a slippery line. I mean, remember when we would say, you know, it's not appropriate. Somebody would say it's not appropriate to call the president a liar.
That's right.
But then we decided a lie is a lie. And I must say, I was there quite early, but there was a lot of people who
you must say that. You just must.
I think I may have beat you on this one, Alan. I remember calling him a pathological liar many months prior.
I don't want to be a 10-year-old.
I do.
If you're just joining us, the Media Project from WAMC, Alan Shartok and Ira Fussfeld, Caitlin Brown, and I'm Rex Smith. About these debates, there has been criticism of the moderators. What do you think about this? As Eugene Robinson, the political commentator from the Washington Post, said in one of the post-debate analyses, the clear intent was to spark fights. That seemed to be the point of moderation. Or as Paul Farhi, the Washington Post media reporter, put it, the thrust of much of the questioning, which of your rivals for the nomination is really, really full of it.
Yeah, I agree with that criticism 100%. I, for one, hate these debates. The only reason I watched the most recent one is because I know I was going to be here and asked to comment on it. I think that they do a great disservice. There's more negative than positive, regardless of the party's debate. You know, this particular one, it's not a media point, but it's going to be very difficult for the Democrats to emerge whole after they fight with each other like that, and the only one that benefits is the Republicans.
But is it the moderators, isn't it their role to try to help suss out the differences among the candidates? If you didn't get in there a little bit, how would you depart from just the simple talking points that each of the candidates has?
Well, I agree with you, Rex, although I must say I just learned another word that I didn't know, which was suss out.
Suss out the difference. You don't know that word?
I don't know that word either.
Really?
Suss out.
Never mind.
Maybe that's a Midwestern term.
I have not read where the moderator's questions came from, but I think there's value in future debates, including polling prior to the debates of the American people, to find out what it is they want the moderators to ask the candidates.
Well, what if they don't give a damn about climate change? You think that the moderators shouldn't ask about it?
I'm pretty sure, Alan, that the American people care about climate change.
I don't know.
At least those of us who choose to stay alive.
I don't know.
But the point is, if the first question is to whichever candidate, the moderator in CNN has an idea what this candidate is going to say, and then the moderator shifts to another candidate candidate who he or she knows is going to be in conflict. And so are they simply asking questions to elicit information, or are they scripting this to elicit a fight, keep the viewers listening for the full 2.5 hours of what is often tedium? They seem to want to generate. Yes, they want to generate information, but I believe they do want to generate conflict.
I agree, right. Ira. I agree. They did do that. And that's not their job, to encourage conflict.
Well, I don't know. I mean, their job is what they say their job is. They're journalists. They say, look, we want to get information. Now we want to find out if there's a difference between Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. I mean, I hate the fact that the Democrats are destroying themselves through their greed in all of this, but I don't know that it isn't their job.
Well, you know, in the next round of debates, where fewer candidates will qualify for the stage, I think it will make the task of the moderators somewhat easier, because they won't have to almost artificially reach out to candidates who realistically have no chance of winning the nomination.
Yeah.
You know, John Delaney, the former Maryland congressman, you know, he just doesn't register in the polls. But Delaney,
for good reason, by the way.
Yeah. He gets an outsized role in the debates because the moderators are trying to bend over backwards to be fair to everybody. And so it will be interesting to see what happens in the next round of debates if people feel as though the moderators do a better job of it.
Well, my advice to the public is read the New York Times. You'll get a summation of what happened at the debate. You'll get commentary from all sides, and you'll be better informed than you will be watching one of the cable networks.
I want to go back, if I may, just for a second, Rex, to Professor Brown's point about educating students. When I was at the New Lincoln School, our teacher, Sid Simon, who lives in our area, made us read the New York Times every day, every day. But not only that, he taught us how to fold it. So when you're on the subway.
That's a trick. You must learn that if you're riding the subway. It's one of the first things you learn, how to fold a paper.
Alan, I also require my students to read the New York Times every day. And I encourage them to also read other newspapers as well. And I, too, taught my students how to fold the newspaper and throw it because they're required to deliver hard copy newspapers in the neighborhood where they write.
Really? They deliver?
They deliver to 16 off-campus locations.
Well, God bless them. Wow. I mean, that's really actually, you know, you talk about training journalists for everything. It's not just that they're going to have to take pictures and tape and video. They're going to have to deliver the paper, too.
I know.
This is definitely a contemporary journalism program. What percentage of your students have ever read a hard copy paper before they get into your class then?
Not that many.
Yeah.
Not that many. Especially when that Jamal Khashoggi story came up, and I talked to them about that at the beginning of that semester, most did not know who he was.
Had no idea, right.
And therein lies the rub.
Right. There is not enough interest in hard news, and that has real consequences. We're out of time.
Hard as
it is to believe. We are at the end of another week of the Media Project. Dr. Alan Shartok, we are grateful to. Ira Fussfeld from the Kingston Daily Freeman, Kaylin Brown from the College of St. Rose, and I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. Thanks to our producer, David Gustina, and to all of you for tuning us in this week on the Media Project.
But publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.